This is Git Minutes episode 16, where we talk to Joey Hess about Git and X. Git Minutes is a listener-supported show for proficient Git users, featuring stories, discussions, ideas, demos, and other things useful for those using Git today. I'm your host, Thomas Ferris Nikolaisen, and you can find more information about the show and how to support it on gitminutes.com. This episode is recorded on the 11th of July, 2013, and the show notes are available on links.gitminutes.com/16. So today we are talking to Joey Hess. Joey has worked on Debian since the 90s, including building the Debian installer. We've already mentioned Git and X many times on this podcast, so most of you should know it is a tool for tracking large external files from Git repositories, and Joey is the creator of this tool. So, Joey, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Thomas. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. So, let's start how we always do, and we go back in time, and you tell us how you arrived at where you are today.
Well, as far as where I'm at today with Git, I guess we have to go back to the beginning of the millennium when I was working at this little company called VA Linux, doing Linux stuff, and started trying to check my whole home directory into version control. And back then it was CVS, but of course I've eventually transitioned over to Git. And I've kind of been building various tools to help different interesting ways to use version control ever since.
Mm-hmm. And I think I saw somewhere some mention of using Subversion as well. Have you kind of transitioned through Subversion?
I started off, I think, using CVS, and then, you know, so we switched over to Subversion as quickly as we could. And used that for several years before I got into Git.
Yeah. Was that like my idea of when Subversion kind of became the normal thing is like around 2005 or earlier, and then 2010 is kind of when Git became mainstream, so to speak. What kind of time schedule did you follow in your transition?
Well, let's see. I think that I first heard about Git right after Linus started posting to Linux kernel mailing list about it, because I read Linux Weekly News and they were talking about it back then, but I didn't use it at that point, which was in 2005 or something like that, right? I think that I started using it around 2007, so probably a little bit before it was mainstream, but it was clear that either Git or Mercurial or something, some distributed version control system, was going to take over from Subversion. And we were all kind of the penguins, you know, on the ice floe, seeing who's going to jump where. And eventually, you know, we all jumped to Git right around then.
Yeah. Well, you've been working on some other open source projects in the past as well. Can you give us a quick iteration of what you've been working on?
Well, how far back do you want to go?
Well, ETC Keeper, for example?
Yeah, I think that I actually only wrote ETC Keeper after I switched to Git, because when I was using Subversion, I always thought, wouldn't it be great to be able to keep your /etc directory in version control? But with Subversion, it would basically be impossible. You have all these .svn directories everywhere, and you don't want to leak information like your password file, your shadow file. You don't want people to be able to look inside your version control system and pull that out. So you couldn't really use Subversion for it, and besides, it would need a centralized repository somewhere. It just didn't work. So pretty soon after I switched over to Git, I put ETC Keeper together and wrote it in a couple of days, put it out there, and got a ton of patches adding all these different other distributed version control systems to it, and then just kind of used it, and then came back to it a few years ago and realized that all these people everywhere are using it, which is just awesome, but I really had no idea. I looked for it on Twitter and saw that people were tweeting about it every day, and I was just like, wow.
Cool. Yeah, it does remind me a bit of what we talked about on a previous episode with Richard Hartman. We talked about VCSH, right, which is like a tool for tracking your home directory files in Git.
Right.
Is that kind of a similar tool?
Yeah, what ETC Keeper does is it just basically makes your /etc directory a Git repository, and then when you type ETC Keeper commit, it automatically adds any things that have changed and commits it. You can also use Git directly. And then if you use a package manager, say you use apt-get or yum or something like that to install a package, and it modifies some files in there, it'll automatically commit it saying these packages were installed or upgraded. So you can kind of get a history of what's going on in your system. If you're using sudo and you have, say, multiple people administrating the system, then it'll say this guy was using sudo and made a commit, and you can actually see which of the admins is responsible for breaking the system or whatever.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like what we're using Puppet for these days.
Yeah, and I think you can kind of use it with Puppet or instead of Puppet if you don't have a big, you know, you're not really ready to deploy Puppet or something like that. You're just managing a simple system. So it doesn't really handle the distributed control of multiple systems the same way Puppet does. It's a different use case, really.
And what other projects do you have on your portfolio, so to speak?
Well, as far as ones using Git, I have this wiki that I wrote called IckyWiki. I actually originally wrote it using CVS or Subversion or something as the back end, but we switched over to Git as soon as Git became, you know, widely used. And the idea there is it's a static wiki engine. It builds HTML files out of Git, and then it has a web interface, so if people go in and edit a page, it makes a commit behind the scenes automatically. So that's another
cool.
You know, another neat way to use Git. There's a lot of things doing things like that now, but when I started it back in 2003 or something, it was a pretty new idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so long ago that we got like the ability to edit files in GitHub.
Yeah, and delete directly. Files and things like that, yeah. So I've done all that with WikiWiki long ago, but, you know, just for documents, not for source code particularly.
Oh, that's really cool to hear that. It wasn't such a novel idea after all. And there's this MR that I've heard a lot about before. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, I will. I can, and I've actually just renamed it because MR is kind of hard to Google for. So I've renamed it to My Repos, which I think kind of explains what it does a little bit better, too. It's for managing your repos, whatever they might be. So I think most people have a lot of Git repositories and maybe one or two repositories of some other thing, or maybe they're a heavy user of BZR or Mercurial or something, so they have a bunch of those. What this does is it's kind of a big for loop around all your repositories. You have a mrconfig file in your home directory, .mrconfig, and you just list them in there, and then you can do things like mr update, and it'll go off and update them all. And so it's kind of like Git submodules, but it doesn't do the tracking the way Git submodules does. And it's kind of like floating Git submodules, but it's not just for Git. It can work with any version control system.
Okay, so the subrepositories are kind of loose in that you don't like make a cross commit across the whole super repository every time one of the submodules changes
subrepositories. Right, if you type mr commit, it'll go off and commit in every repository, which is nice if you're, say, you know, you think you might lose your laptop and you just want to make sure everything's committed and pushed out. You can just say mr commit and then, you know, wham. So it's kind of useful that way. It's a different use case. It's for managing your repositories and not for managing, you know, a project or something. You can kind of think of it as a make file for your version control system repositories, because you can easily define your own custom commands or modify the commands to do special things. So if instead of, you know, just git pull, you want to run git pull dash rebase or something and win one repository every time, you can make mr update do that really easily.
Cool.
So it's
pretty similar to git slave, only git slave is limited to only working on git repositories.
Yeah, I think I only heard about git slave maybe on this podcast or something. It's kind of similar to the repo, I think it's called, that the Android project uses. Yeah, there's a couple of things in the space, of course. MR has kind of been picked up by the people who are doing version controlling of their whole home directory, because it's kind of what I wrote it for. So that's probably where most people use it. Although I have to say that, for example, the Debian installer has about 200 Git repositories that are all managed and checked out with MR and stuff like that.
Cool. So, let's get to the big issue of the day and the solution. Which is, let me start by asking you, why is it such a big problem to store big files in Git?
Well, I think that there's really a couple answers to that. Originally, when I started writing Git Annex, it was a problem because Git had some scalability issues around large files. It would use a lot of memory if you were doing a commit of a large file, for example, and so you go off and commit 200 megabytes and suddenly Git's using at least 200 megabytes or more. And it also has scalability problems that haven't been addressed. I think the memory use has mostly been addressed by now, But for example, if you've committed a lot of big data files into Git and then it goes off and does an automatic Git repack, well, you're stuck waiting for who knows how long while it churns through all this data and compresses it and deltas it and all that. And so that's kind of the scalability issues. But the other thing is that when you have large files in a repository, you probably, you may not want to have them all on your local repository. So, you know, if you have a lot of data, you have a lot of old versions of files, or maybe just a lot of files and you only use a few of them from time to time, then Git doesn't really offer a way to say, well, this file, I'm done with it, just shove it off to a server somewhere, and if I want it, you know, pull it back down, but otherwise I don't have to worry about it eating up my SSD. So that's, and Git has, you know, a few things like shallow clones and stuff like that, but it really doesn't have a good way of managing which objects are checked or present in your Git repository at one time and dealing with them. So that's kind of, I think, the broader problem that Git Annex tries to solve.
And also, I think a detail with these big files is that they're also usually binary files.
Well, yeah, they generally are binary. But Git handles binary files just fine. You know, it, you can't do conflict handling with them very well. But other than that, they're just like any other file as far as Git concerned. But but yeah, they do tend to be binary files. And I think that the way that we work with big files is different in some ways. We often want to keep all the versions of them and just, you know, have them all in one place because it's kind of like we're not using version control for them, right?
Yeah, or they have their own kind of version
right,
control
or maybe they
inside.
Have it built into them or something. And but it's still useful to be able to just check them in and manage them in a version control-esque way, even though you're not going to go in and, you know, change a line here and somebody else is going to change a line there like you might with Git.
Yeah, like the cookbook solution for solving a big file problem in our projects at work is that we kind of have to disconnect them from the source control and make them a part of the build system.
Yeah.
So that when we have like the build system that you know produces our software that. After doing the compiling and whatever it is, then it goes and fetches from some kind of remote repository and pulls in the stuff during build time, and then you know uses it for finishing the build in whatever way.
Yeah, I think Jenkins calls this assets or something like that, where you have different you know things produced or artifacts produced by the build or something like that. Yeah, I think that's probably how most people handle it, or they just email it around, or they have a centralized server somewhere or something. You know, it's all ad hoc, really.
Yeah, probably some people have like a very typical pattern I've seen in like in Windows companies is that they have like a mapped network drives and there's like a convention that everybody maps, you know, the drive Z colon to be to the company media server thing and then they kind of link in with full paths to the convention based media drive.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how they kind of all share the big files.
Right,
but it's
kind
of nasty.
Yeah, and then if somebody accidentally goes into and deletes them all, they're hoping they have them backed up somewhere. And
Yeah, well, if you want to use something else than Windows, then you might be a bit, or you have to find a workaround for those funky paths.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, so Git Annex just tries to, you know, it doesn't store them directly in Git, but it does allow you to version them and do all the things you would do with Git. You can have branches with different versions of the file and all that kind of thing. You can revert changes, all that.
So what? Let's back up a bit. Yep. And what is it exactly, like Git Annex? What is it? What do you install and how does it work?
Okay. So Git Annex is a simple program. It's a single binary. It happens to be written in Haskell. But once you've built it, that really doesn't matter. It's just a binary executable like anything else. So once you get it installed, it adds a Git Annex command to Git. And the Git Annex command has all these subcommands to handle files. So the first one that you'll probably use is Git Annex add, which is just like Git add, except it adds it to the Git Annex instead of directly to Git. And so... and then you'll just do a git commit, just like you normally would, and you'll have a commit with that file in it. Now, the way that it actually works under the hood, which I think is important, because we kind of understand how Git works under the hood to one degree or another, you know. We know about trees and refs and all that, blobs, and so on. The way GitNX actually stores the file in your Git repository in the .git directory is normally Git puts things in .git/objects, and then it has the objects in there, which are the actual contents of your files. GitNX adds a .git/annex/objects directory. And so all the large files are over there rather than where they normally would be in Git. So what actually gets checked into Git is a symlink pointing to the .git/annex/objects directory. And so this means that if you check out the repository somewhere, you end up with a dangling symlink. But then GitNX can go and get the file. You can say GitNX get file, and it'll look and say, oh, here's a symlink, and it's pointing to this unique object. And I know that it's over here, so I'll go get it from there. And then it shoves it into GitNX objects, and you have your file accessible. So that's kind of the core idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, is it like just a completely normal symlink, or is it some kind of fancy symlink that contains a bit more information about the file that it's linking to?
It's a symlink that contains a key, basically. And I don't mean a cryptographic key. I mean a key in the form of a hash. So as in a key value database, you have a key pointing to your value. In this case, you have a hash of the file pointing to the value, which can be in some key value storage somewhere. And so the symlink actually contains basically a SHA-256 hash by default. You can actually change it to different things depending on your use cases, but the SHA-256 worked great for most people. So it's kind of like seeing a git commit ref somewhere. You see this this checksum whenever you look at the ls-l or something.
And this hash or the key is actually just a normal checksum of the file, or the big file in question.
Yep, that's right. Yeah, we just checksum the file, and it tacks on the size of the file just because it's useful to have the size as available as metadata. So that becomes part of the key as well. And by default, we also now tack the extension of the file in there, because I've found that some programs, particularly ones on macOS, look to see what the actual thing that the symlink points to, what its extension is, and then use it as to figure out how to use the file, which is kind of weird, but okay, fine. So we just put the extension in there too. But other than that, it's just a hash. And that means that when you check in two files that have the same content, you get one file stored just like you would in Git normally.
And whenever you happen to change the little thing inside this big binary file, then Git status will pick it up, or do you have to do some gitnx status to see that it's changed?
Well, you can't. Actually, one thing that gitnx prevents you from doing is easily changing a file. This might sound like, what? Why would I not want to change a file? But if you think about it, when you've added a file to GitNX, you have one copy of that file. When you've added a file to Git normally, you have the copy in your working tree, and plus Git's made a copy and stored it off in the .git directory. And that's fine if you're working with source code or something, because it's not very big. But if you have large files, you don't want to have two copies of every file in your repository at all times. And so that means you're kind of working without a safety net. If that file gets deleted or something, you've lost that file until you've synced it off to some other repository somewhere. So GitNX kind of adds a safety net back around this and does things with permissions and stuff to keep you from easily overwriting that file. So when you want to actually change the file, you would type GitNX edit and then the name of the file, and then it would go and make a copy of it. Then you can edit the copy. And then you can commit the copy just like you normally would. You can actually type git commit dash a, and it'll just go off and work. However, it's probably better to type gitnx add, and then the file that you changed, and then it'll hash it again. You can actually end up using a little bit more memory if you use gitnx, if you just do a git commit, just because of git internals.
What actually happens when you write gitnx add?
Well, all it does is first it goes and hashes the file. And it moves it into the GitNX directory. It sets up the symlink. It adds assembly, it stages assembly to Git, and that's it. That's basically all that it does. It also updates some bookkeeping information, which is stored in this Git Annex branch, and that's used later to track which repositories have which file in them. But that's, you know, basically all it does is it sets up the symlink and stages it, and then you commit it as you normally would anything you get added.
Hmm. Okay, so now we got like we got some big files into our repository, and now we want to share this repository with somebody else.
Right.
So all the big files are so far they're still locally on my own computer.
Exactly.
I got them in some you know, big file directory somewhere, and they're just linked into my Git repository.
Perfect. Perfect example. Yeah. So what you're going to do now is you'll probably have an origin or something. Now, this origin, if you're going to be using it with Git Annex, you probably want to have either a separate remote that's on a server you control or something. Let's just say that you have an SSH remote that isn't pointing to GitHub because they don't support Git Annex at this moment. So what you'll do is then you can say Git Annex copy --to origin, and it'll go and say, okay, I'm going to go find all the files that are stored here locally that I know aren't in the origin repository, and it'll copy them over. And it actually uses rsync to transmit them, which means that you can interrupt it at any time and come back later, and you know it'll pick up right where it left off.
That's nice.
Yeah. And once you've done that, it well, you also have to, of course, push your normal branch just like you normally would.
Hmm.
And the other thing you have to make sure to do is to push this Git Annex branch that I mentioned up to the origin repository. And that's because otherwise, if somebody has also cloned that origin repository and they pull down your commit, Git Annex won't know where the files are. And so the Git Annex branch keeps track of all this, and you basically have to arrange to have it pushed automatically. Now, to simplify all this out a little bit, there's a command called Git Annex sync that automatically does a commit and a normal push and also pushes the Git Annex branch and also does a pull and a merge and things like that. So it just automates the whole process. So people who are using Git Annex and want a simple workflow can just type Git Annex sync and know that all their changes have been sent up and anything has been pulled down.
Cool. So, I mean, it's kind of important here that the order goes correctly so that the before I kind of push the normal Git branch, that the big files are already out there where they're supposed to be,
really,
and
does,
that this...
The ordering really doesn't matter that much. If you do it in the wrong order, all that'll, or say you just forget to do it. You know, you push it out, and you've kept the file locally on your laptop, and then your coworker pulls it down, and he types Git Annex get file. Well, it'll say, well, I don't know where to get this file from. I know that it's on Thomas's laptop.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the Git Annex branch is for. That's why we need that. It's so that we have a way of it of communicating. Then you can, you know, then he can go contact you and say, hey, you forgot to push this. You know, go type Git Annex copy to remote. And wham, then it's fixed. So that's basically, the order doesn't really matter. And, you know, where you keep, you know, where the file is all handled by Git Annex. You don't really have to worry about it yourself.
Hmm. I suppose for the sake of argument, I could make a server-side, a hook in the central Git repository that checks inside this Git Annex branch, and in case there has been a missing push, then I could, you know, go off and send an email to the committer and say, hey, you forgot to sync the Git Annex.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, you could even just reject the push entirely and say sorry. You know, you need to push this stuff. And I keep thinking that somebody's going to do that. Nobody is that I've talked to has done it yet. I think it'd be pretty easy to do. And if somebody wants that, I'll happily, you know, add whatever they need and get Annex to support it. But it should be quite easy. Yeah. So I mean, you know, if you're working in a company, I think that'd be something you would really want.
Mm.
Because otherwise, gosh, guy runs off with his laptop and, you know, work is gone. It's not a good thing. Yeah.
Okay, that was a server. We just pushed our big files to over SSH or rsync to a remote server. Are there any other kind of storage possibilities for putting these big files?
So I mentioned that it doesn't work with GitHub. And that's just because it has to be able to run rsync to the server, and GitHub doesn't support rsync. and they probably don't want you shoving large files up to them anyway if you're talking really large. GitHub supports quite a few different ways of storing the files. I mentioned before that it's kind of a key value store. And so basically any kind of key value store that you can think of in the cloud or some other place, you can use with GitAnnex quite easily. Now, the simplest one to use is just you can have another drive somewhere, and you can just tell GitAnnex to push the files off to that drive. And you could have a Git repository there, but you could also just have a plain directory without any Git repository and use what's called a special remote. And the neat thing about doing this is it lets GitAnnex actually encrypt the files before it sends them off to the special remote. So you can have a drive that, say, use a backup or something, and you can have all your files be encrypted before they land on that drive. And GitAnnex knows where they are, so if you've lost a file, it can go pull it off the drive and that kind of thing. Now, that's the simple local solution, but we've also added support for all kinds of cloud services. Any server that has an rsync connection and it doesn't have to have even GitAnnex installed on it can be used to store data. So we can store data in, for example, rsync.net. We can send data to Amazon S3 and store it there and pull it back down. And that, you know, this is where it automatically, well, it doesn't automatically encrypt it, but you get to choose whether it encrypts all the data or not. It's probably a good idea to encrypt things if, say, you're working at a company or you have your personal data and you're setting it up to these servers. And let's see, rsync.net, we have web dev support, which supports, you know, several cloud services. It's pretty easy to add support for another cloud service, especially because there's a hook system built into GitAnnex. And this kind of lets you add support for a cloud service by just implementing get and put and delete and check if it's there. Basically, four verbs, if you can map them to your cloud service and you can write four shell commands, you can add support. You remember when Flickr recently changed to having a terabyte of disk storage for free. The day after that happened, somebody popped up with a support for storing arbitrary files in Flickr. And the same day, somebody made that support GitAnnex or made GitAnnex support that. So
that was quick.
You can, in theory, push terabytes of stuff up to Flickr. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. But, yeah. And one of the things that GitAnnex lets you do is tell it how much to trust a remote like that. You could say, don't trust Flickr. You know, I don't know. They might just kill all this stuff tomorrow. And that's fine. GitAnnex will send stuff up there, but it won't let that be the only place that it's stored. And you can also tell GitAnnex to configure how many copies you'd like to have of a file between all the different repositories. And it'll refuse to delete the file unless that's met. So once you've done that, you start getting into having a little bit of assurance that your data isn't going to be deleted if you lose a drive or a laptop or something. I tend to configure GitAnnex to have like five copies of stuff that I care about.
Wow, that's redundancy.
Well, you know, it's a little bit of redundancy.
You have a lot of bad luck.
Just don't want to have any.
So if I go for just like the normal remote Linux server, which I'm likely to do at work, because there we kind of have a very simple Debian server, actually, which is reachable over SSH. And if I would tell GitAnnex to, okay, go there to this server and store the big files there, what would it look like there on the file system? Would that be like a Git repository, or would it look different?
Well, I'm assuming that you probably already have a Git repository on your server at work, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have a bare Git repository there, and that's your origin or whatever you call it, repository. And so when you use GitAnnex with that or with that remote in your repository on your laptop, it will send the files off into the same bare Git repository. And where with a normal Git repository, a Git checkout, they're in .git/annex/objects. With a bare repository, they're just going to be in annex/objects inside the bare repository. So just like Git, you have the same layout with a bare and a non-bare repository. And, you know, it all works pretty much the same.
Nice, nice.
Yeah.
And so if I want to check out the repository, or a colleague wants to check out the repository, and I don't want him to force to do the big download right away.
Right. and you're not forced.
So he'll do a normal Git clone, I suppose.
Yep.
And then later on, he gets around to, and he says, Thomas, now I need these big files. Right. Tell me what to do.
Yeah, and then you'll tell him, well, first of all, install Git Annex. And that's mm-hmm. pretty easy. It's actually in pretty much all the major Linux distributions now. There's an Easy Mac app that you can install and stuff like that. So he'll install it, and then he can just run Git Annex get and pass it the name of the file, or he can just run it with, you know, dot and get everything. And so it's
really cool.
Yeah.
So you can kind of select on a file-by-file basis which are the big files you want to have.
Yeah, right. And once you get done with the file, you can say git annex drop file, and it'll go off and check, like I was talking about, that enough copies of it exist, and then delete it from your local computer. So once he's done working on, you know, whatever project needs this file, he can move away from it and not waste space.
Hmm. So you said that Git Annex will kind of lock the file until you tell it to allow it to be edited. Mm-hmm. How does that work exactly? Is that using like standard file system locking, or is it something else?
Yeah, right now it's using standard file system locking. I'd like to use immutable files or something, but you currently, I think, have to be root to be able to do that. So all it does is it makes a directory. Actually, each file has its own directory under .gitannex/objects. And the directory is then locked down so that you can't write to it. So it puts a file in, and then it changes the permissions so you can't write to the directory. It fixes the file's permissions so you can't write to the file. And what this prevents you from doing is, unless you go in and manually tweak file modes, you can't just accidentally overwrite the file or something like that. So even if you type rm-rf, it's not going to go off and delete it. You'll have to go fix the permissions up, yeah.
So, and all the time, I suppose, Git Annex will provide you with like friendly error messages on why you can't edit this file.
Well, when you try to edit a file, you're not going to be running Git Annex. You'll just pull it up in, you know, whatever the program is. And if it tries to save it, it'll say, well, you know, permission denied or something. Oh. And you'll have to go unlock it at that point or save it to another place or whatever. Now,
okay, so a little education will be necessary.
Would be necessary, but I haven't talked about direct mode yet, which is a feature that I kind of added to Git Annex in the past year. I was involved in this Kickstarter to build something on top of Git Annex, which you might want to talk about a bit later. But direct mode, but direct mode was part of that. And what it does is it gets rid of the symlinks as far as you're concerned as the end user. It's still committing symlinks to Git and everything. But you just see the files directly in the working tree, just like you would any other file, and you can edit them as you like. And then when you type git annex add, it'll check it back in. So that can allow for other workflows. But I have to say that using direct mode has quite a few caveats about which git commands are safe to run. Because what we're doing is git thinks it should be a symlink, and we're just putting a real file there. And so if you type something like git commit -a, it'll go off and commit the whole file into git, which is probably not what you want. Even worse, if you type git checkout or something, it'll replace some of your files with symlinks and lose the content, which is, again, not what you want. So direct mode is kind of a work in progress, but I think eventually we're going to have some kind of a little porcelain around it to make it more usable for, at the command line. Right now it's more useful with the GitX assistant.
Hmm. So a couple of months ago, I was at this Git conference in Berlin,
yeah.
And I was talking briefly with Jeff King from the Git developer.
I actually heard that interview, and I thought it was a great interview. And I saw came up in that.
Yeah, because he said something about kind of supporting a similar mechanism natively inside of Git.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I'd kind of love to see it happen. I kind of think that some of the problems, like I was talking about earlier, some of the things that Git Annex deals with could be dealt with in Git. And then some of the things, like this business of having some files that are locally available and some that aren't, you kind of still need a command to manage that, you know, whether it's built into Git or whether it's Git Annex. And so I kind of think that... maybe Git will become, maybe we'll get all the support. That'd be great. I'd be perfectly happy if that happened. I don't know if whatever ends up landing in Git will handle the same use cases as Git Annex or not, of course, at this point.
Hmm. Yeah, it may take some time. Yeah. And Not sure if the Git core is willing to accept some Haskell coding.
Yeah, somehow I doubt it. But maybe the ideas behind it could be useful.
I think they start twitching as soon as they air Python.
Yeah, pretty much.
Haskell might be a bit of a far stretch.
Yeah.
Before we go on to talk about the Git Annex assistant,
yeah.
As a programmer, I'm kind of curious how your experience with the development in Haskell has been.
Yeah, well, Git Annex was the first Haskell program that I wrote. I moved out here to this kind of a cabin out in the woods in the middle of nowhere, which is why you had to call me up over the phone to record this thing. And I kind of found out that, I didn't have any tools to manage files when I'm pretty much offline and on dial-up all the time. And, of course, Git's great for that, but I had all these media files and whatnot that I, needed to deal with. And I was like, okay, I'm going to build this tool, and I've been trying to learn Haskell for like 4 years or something, and I've never managed to write anything more than Hello World in it. So this seems like something that, it doesn't really matter if it takes an extra week to write in Haskell. I figured if I wrote it as a Perl script, I could do it in a day, right? It's not really a very complicated idea. And so I went off and, fought Haskell for a couple of weeks and came out with something that basically worked. And I've kind of been, really happy with Haskell ever since, mostly. Go ahead.
Sorry. My impression of Haskell is that it's like kind of close to the metal runtime. It, I don't know if it runs on some kind of virtual layer in between.
Yeah, there's not really a virtual layer, not in the sense of a JVM. And it is pretty bare metal. You can, people talk about writing Haskell that's as fast or faster than C code and say maybe, it's a couple of times slower until you optimize it. And I think that's probably about right. It's the Haskell that I write tends to be a lot faster than if I wrote in, say, Perl or Python or something, I think would be. But what I've really found great about it is, if I'd written Git Annex as some little Perl hack, a couple of hundred line Perl script or something, I don't think I would have been able to evolve it into what I've evolved into. Because Haskell kind of gave me a really firm base to build things on. And it really forced me to, build something that was fairly conceptually clean from the beginning. And it's let me do all this wonderful stuff with threads later on and things like that. So, I can't really imagine coding in anything else anymore, although I certainly write a fair amount of code in other languages, but I'm always kind of thinking like I'm writing Haskell and just trying to write Java or something.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, the rumor is that like Haskell, it's a functional programming language with a static types or a typing system out of this world. It's so powerful, I've heard, that you can kind of almost guarantee that your program is bug-free just by compiling it.
Well, that's kind of a bit of an over-exaggeration, but you can certainly catch a vast majority of the bugs you'd have to catch with some kind of a unit test system. But, I still have my own unit tests for Git Annex, and they catch bugs on occasion, and that's, you can still invert a true to a false, even no matter how good your type system is. Well, maybe some of the Haskell gods can think of ways to, avoid doing that, but I can't normally. So.
Yeah, Haskell is also I think they kind of came up with this idea of, is it called Q unit or this?
Oh, you're thinking about quick check. Which is awesome. I have some quick check tests, not enough. I wish I had more. But they're really cool. If you have like, say you're encoding a string or encoding, some data structure into a format and you're decoding it, and you know that you want to write both the encoder and the decoder, well, quick check can go generate arbitrary random versions of this data structure. Whatever the data structure is, it doesn't matter. You can change it, and QuickCheck will just be able to make a new version of it. It's insane. And so then you can just speed it through both of your functions, encode it to a string and then decode it, make sure you got the same thing out. And you set this up before you even start writing your code, and, your code just tests itself as you go along. It's really awesome when you use it that way. Yeah. And it's actually available for quite a few other programming languages now, although I don't think probably with quite the beauty of Haskell, but you can still use the same idea.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we're ready for, let's talk a bit about your Kickstarter project. So tell us what Git Annex Assistant is about.
Well, okay. It kind of started, you know, more than a year ago. I was noticing that I was kind of getting requests for users for Git Annex to be easier to use, and they wanted to, you know, not have to worry about all the Git commands if they're just managing, say, their music collection or something with Git Annex, which I completely understand because I manage mine with Git Annex too, and, you know, you don't want to have to git add every podcast that you download and all that kind of thing. And so I eventually came up with this idea for the Git Annex Assistant, and basically what it is a daemon that you run, and it watches over your Git repository, and it kind of does something like Dropbox does. If you have multiple clones of your repository scattered around and you're running the assistant in them all, it'll communicate between the different instances of it. And whenever you change a file, it'll automatically commit it to Git and push it out and transfer the data and all that. And also, it's also got a web interface on top of it, which runs on your local computer. So you can, you know, control it. You can easily go in and set up new repositories without having to type anything in a command line. So at this point, it's easy enough that I can literally say that my mom uses it to manage. We were exchanging family photos from the 1850s this past week, and, you know, via Git, and she never had to type a thing, just dragging wow. around. Yeah. So
it's like the ultimate user test.
Well, yeah. You got to get your mom to use it.
Well, it would be so cool if I could get my mom to use Git.
Yeah, I'm amazed that my mom has made her first Git commit at, like, you know, 75.
Well, I will have to take that for a spin. Right now, we're kind of very heavily into the whole Google infrastructure of Google Plus and sending, uploading family photos and videos in an increasing degree. But I just noticed, you know, in recent news with all the Prism and the privacy stuff going on with you dare Americans the NSA is like monitoring what's going on over American web services.
Yeah.
And there's a site called prismbreak.org which kind of lists all the alternatives for your typical you know, online services and applications, you know, be it Gmail or Dropbox or whatever. And down where it says Dropbox, like actually Git Annex Assistant is mentioned as the private alternative for those who don't want to be monitored by the NSA.
Yeah, I'm really happy that I got on there. I had nothing to do with that, but I guess one of my users, you know, told them about it. You know, like I was saying earlier, all the data that's sent up to the cloud, you still have to use the cloud to send data in between, you know, your computer at home, your computer at work, your mom's computer at her house, and that kind of thing. So Git Annex does send data up to, you know, various providers that you set up, but it does encrypt it. Pretty much, we still have a little bit of work to do. For example, there's this crazy hack involving using XMPP or Jabber to basically do a Git push directly between two client computers using Jabber, and it just tunnels it all over the Jabber connection.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, it's kind of great because you don't have to have a centralized Git server then. But it actually currently, it's only encrypted with TLS. So in theory, Prism, you know, who knows what it does, maybe could look at it. So I want to try to improve the encryption, but I think it's already pretty good.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what kind of implication it has to this whole Prism thing has for, you know, European companies that are storing their private repositories on American servers.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I'm sure some people are thinking about that, aren't they? I would be happier if, you know, the European companies or whoever had the ability to, first of all, encrypt everything that they send to any, you know, anybody, anything they don't control, and secondly, you know, if they decide that the provider they're using isn't one that they want to be locked into using, they can easily switch. And so these are kind of some of the things that Git Annex has been trying to do with its special remote support. Because, you know, to Git, it doesn't matter if you're using rsync.net or if you're using, you know, box.com, which is this kind of Dropbox clone that Git Annex can support, or if you're using Amazon S3, or if you've put up your own SSH server, you know, it's using basically the same interfaces. Well, not the same interfaces, but the same key value storage for all of them. And so you can migrate between them quite easily.
Hmm. So let me ask, is the Git Annex Assistant, is that kind of completely tied to Git Annex? Or is it just kind of, it just happens to use Git Annex for storing the files remotely?
There was something actually before I wrote the Git Annex Assistant, and it still exists, called DVCS Autosync. And it was a kind of the same idea of just, you know, you put a file in and it gets committed to Git, but it committed directly to Git. And so you could just, you know, use it to share your notes or something easily. There's also Sparkle Share, which I believe does the same thing, although I haven't looked at it closely. So GitAnnex Assistant can actually handle that use case now. We recently added a way to say, here's, you know, basically if it matches star.org or something, it's a large file. Or if it's larger than a megabyte, it's a large file. Otherwise, just commit it directly to Git. And then the GitAnnex Assistant, if you configure it to say commit all your C files directly to Git, you can use it, you know, just as a backend for your IDE or something, and you're not using the large file stuff. So it is kind of, you know, it's kind of feature creep on top of Git Annex in a way. Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So you mentioned it was a Kickstarter project, and the first thing that strikes me when I look at the Kickstarter project page is that you asked for $3,000, dollars, and then you ended up getting $25,000.
Wasn't that great? Yeah, and, I mean, you know, I really just wanted, you know, I wanted to have a basically a Joey Summer of Code. I was thinking of it that way. You know, I've mentored Google Summer of Code before, and I was like, you know, if I were in Google Summer of Code as a student, I could try to bang out something in 3 months. It was kind of a prototype and did these things. So that's what I asked for. You know, cool. I wasn't trying to become Joey Moneybags or something. I just wanted enough money to get through the summer, and I live pretty cheap out here. And so I was really happy when it took off, and I'm really happy that I've had all the extra time. I basically was funded for a full year to work on it through that Kickstarter, and I added, you know, a lot of stuff, and I made it a lot more robust, obviously, than it would have been after 3 months. And it's really been great that happened. I was really, really, you know, amazed that it took off like that.
I mean, I see that you have like a blog where you document or publish like your progress from you know, day to day.
Yeah, pretty much every day. And, yeah, that was and, fun to keep up to date mostly.
And I saw also in the Kickstarter that like the big spenders were kind of allowed to influence the development of the project. Can you kind of tell me a bit more about the process?
I mean, that's kind of a tricky thing when you're doing free software development or open source development, because you don't want to have somebody come in and pay a bunch of money and just take over and, you know, make decisions that aren't the right ones. What I did is those folks, I got in touch with them, and, you know, I let them describe how they wanted to use it, and you know, I gave them, you know, early access, not that everybody else didn't have early access, but, you know, I was there to support them and things like that. And that worked out pretty well, I think. I don't know. I hope they feel they got their money's worth out of that. I think most of them just wanted to support the project and thought that was, you know, a good level. What I have to say, what's really worked out really well as far as letting people influence my project is I've been putting up polls. And I let anybody vote in it, but, you know, it's just been like, should I work on Android this month, or is it more important to work on direct mode, or something like that. And every single time I've done this, I've just been surprised by, okay, when I think about the answer, it's the right answer, and it wasn't the answer I had in mind when I posted the poll, you know. So I think that's something that just works great, and I'm going to keep doing that. The, you know, individual donations for access, yeah. And it's a pretty good way to. It's hard to think of things for a Kickstarter for a piece of software, because you can't really give away too much. You know, it's just swag and then what else?
Yeah. Let me ask you, what was like the biggest surprise you got that the users wanted?
It was mostly just prioritization. I think it was direct mode, which I talked about earlier, the thing where you know, you can edit the files directly. And I'm sure that was because of all the people using Macs. You know, which I didn't have much exposure to, and I didn't realize how annoying it was for them. And so I was like, should I do Android first or direct mode first? And I was thinking, it's got to be Android. That's the cool thing. Everybody's going to want an Android port right now. But no, they wanted direct mode. And that actually turned out to be the right answer, because if I hadn't done direct mode first, the Android port would have been 10 times as hard. So we're probably just blocked on it anyway. So yeah, things like that. It worked out really well to have those polls.
Yeah, every time I've been asked, or every time I told somebody about Git Annex as a potential solution for their, you know, big binary file problems with Git, and they ask, you know, does it work on Windows?
Yeah.
And I say what I saw on your or on the project page sometime, that it, you know, it could work, but it hasn't been tested.
So the current status is a little bit beyond that. I spent the last month, pretty much, of the Kickstarter period working on the Windows port. I got it all to compile, which was a lot of work. There's a lot of assumptions about symlinks and stuff, and we can't even use symlinks in Windows, really. It has some equivalents, but nothing that's a one-to-one mapping, and nothing, more importantly, that Git supports, unless you're using Cygwin. And so I got it working in direct mode, and I actually got it to pass the test suite just about, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. And that was a nice milestone. Yeah, I did have to stub out a couple of things, but it's nothing that you're going to use in everyday use. And hopefully, I think we're going to get this Windows port. You know, if I have enough time and motivation to work on it, we'll eventually get the full assistant going on Windows, and it'll be just, you know, work pretty much as well as on Android or something like that. Yeah, I never would have done that without the Kickstarter, believe me.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
So, what is the... So you got Windows support almost just about there.
Yeah.
And tell me about how is it working on Android and OS X and so on?
Yeah. Okay, well, of course, the Linux support, that's the first platform that I built it on. It works fairly well on the BSDs. It works better than that on OS X because I've added, you know, I've used things like SF events for the GitAx assistant. It needs to notice when you've changed a file. And on Linux, that's something called iNotify. And on the BSDs, it's KQ. On Mac, it's FS events. And it supports that, and it works quite well. So the Mac has, you know, a DMG installer. You can download it and click, and it comes up and stuff like that. It works pretty well. I'm not a Mac developer guy, but I was pretty happy with how easy it was to, you know, mostly to port it. And then the port to Android was quite difficult, partly because when I started it, there was no Haskell compiler for Android. And and I got really lucky, and one kind of appeared right when I needed it to, but then I had to do a lot of porting work just to port all the libraries over and things. And I actually ended up porting things like Git. So we run native Git on Android. It's all bundled up inside the Git Annex APK for Android. And it has native Git, it has SSH, it has GPG. All these are just the native stuff right ripped out of Linux and ported over. So that was a lot of work on its own. And then, you know, there was more work. It has its own terminal because, you know, you probably want a terminal. And stuff like that. The Android port is still pretty rough around the edges, but a lot of people are using it, and it does work, which is, I'm pretty amazed that it's at that point already, so hopefully it'll just keep improving. Yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, it sounds already like it would be a cool motivation to learn Haskell.
Yeah,
so you can go and build Android applications with it.
Yeah, I really hope that Haskell and Android takes off. I think it would be a really neat thing to do. It currently has a couple of limitations. There's this thing called Template Haskell that isn't supported, that I used extensively. I had to come up with all these nasty workarounds for. And, you know, just getting an environment that works is pretty tricky at this point. But maybe with a bit of time down the road, people will just be able to pull up, you know, a Haskell REPL in their Android and type away and run code. I think that'd be awesome. And the other thing is, I have this web app, which is, you know, the front end to the GitAx assistant, and that worked out really well porting to Android because I didn't have to rewrite the whole UI or anything. I just you know, pop up a web browser and open it up, and there it is, pretty much.
Very cool. The next thing I wanted to ask you about is the GUI. Yeah. It's just a web application. So yeah. When I install the assistant on my machine, it runs and it pops up. Does it open like inside my default browser, or does it bring along its own browser or something like that?
Yeah, I don't bring along my own browser. It just pops up inside your default browser in a tab, and you know, it automatically comes up with its own port and all that stuff, and does it fairly securely. Mm. And Yeah, so you basically just, it's really nice because I've been able to use all kinds of web technologies. I use jQuery and Twitter Bootstrap and all that kind of thing just to build it, and it's made it quite easy to, quickly iterate over stuff and things like that, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask why it looks so nice.
It's just Twitter Bootstrap. It looks so boring at this point, right? Everything's using it.
Yeah, well, it looks nice still. I mean, no offense, but the Iki Wiki could need some Twitter Bootstrap as well.
Oh, I know. I keep meaning to do a Bootstrap theme for that just to go along with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very doable. People have done it. I'm just not happy with it yet, so I haven't rolled it out. But yeah, you get all these nice GUI elements with Twitter Bootstrap. It's great to have dropdowns and all that stuff without having to write any weird CSS or anything. And I'm really happy with it. Yeah.
I suppose that an iOS port will be out of the question. I heard some bad rumors about the kind of access to the file system there.
Well, I don't know anything about access to the file system. I do know there's a Haskell port for iOS now, and it's actually probably farther along than the Android one. But I don't know. I don't think I could ever put it in their app store. From what I've heard, free software isn't really allowed there, and it's kind of turned me off to even looking at it. You know, if they want to change that policy, I'll look at it. But otherwise, I think somebody else would have to do it, or and just distribute it on their own. And how well would that work? I have no idea. And the other problem is it runs as a daemon, and I don't. Gosh, that's a whole other ball of wax on iOS, isn't it?
So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure they have kind of.
Yeah,
I'm sure they have their mechanisms for letting things run in the background.
Yeah, but they're all different.
What I heard about, I think I discussed it with Roberto Tiley, who made like Agit, which is a Git repository browser for Android.
Yeah, I've seen that. That's cool. Yeah.
And he told me that making something like that for iOS would be really difficult because you don't really get to touch the file system in the same way you can do on Android.
Yeah, that just seems like a killer right there. I hadn't realized that it has such limits on the file system. I guess you can just compile everything into JavaScript and run it, but gosh, it doesn't seem very feasible.
I mean, I'm not an iOS developer at all, so don't take my word for it.
Yeah.
All the things that we talked about cross-platform between Windows and Linux, does that also apply to Git Annex itself, more or less?
Do you mean it's GitHub cross-platform between Linux and Windows? Because it is. Yeah, I mean...
So, Git Annex versus the Git Annex Assistant.
I haven't got around to porting the Git Annex Assistant to Windows yet, partly because I have to find out their equivalent for iNotify and get it working, but I don't think that'll be very hard, and partly because I just haven't sunk the time in. I really don't think it'll be that hard to do. Basically, because like I said, I already have, once I get the web interface up, I have it, and I probably won't have to change a thing. Maybe put in some tweaks to make it work in MSIE. And that's about it, once I get it all to build, I think. And it's probably another month's work or so, and maybe I'll get around to it if there's demand.
Yeah, I imagine. I don't think there are so many... people who would be installing the assistant who are still using Internet Explorer, although there's always somebody who are forced to do it for some political reason.
Yeah, my Windows dev laptop is kind of completely generic, and it's also running like Windows, ME or something.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's not connected to the Internet, and I don't use it for anything else. I just bought it to develop the Linux on.
Better not connected. It'll probably explode.
If I connected it, it would run out of disk space immediately downloading updates, I'm sure. But I don't actually ship anything from that laptop either. I actually, the people who do the MS Git builds for Windows, a company in Germany, kindly gave me access to their Jenkins farm. And so I can just commit and it just gets built. It's awesome.
That's nice.
These days, I mostly, when I get bug reports from Windows users, I just fix them and then see if it builds and then never touch Windows. And that's pretty much how I'd be happy to be.
So I suppose that like the funders who were helping with the prioritization, they didn't focus too much on getting support on Windows then.
there were quite a few people who said, you know, to really use this, I'd really like to be able to put it on, you know, family member X computer, and he or she uses Windows. And so there was quite a bit of interest, and that's why, you know, in the end, I gradually said, I'll do a whole month to get this Windows thing working. Or I said, I'll spend a whole month on this Windows thing. I couldn't really commit to getting it working in a month, although I kind of did. you know, we'll see. I'm kind of, you know, seeing what the level of interest is for using it at the command line and then trying to gauge from there, you know, how important it really is. And, you know, I don't want to sink too much time into a dying system, right?
Yeah. it could be... I didn't read too much up on it, but I heard saw somewhere there was a mention of a new file system for Windows coming and stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't know anything about it. Hope that they keep something vaguely POSIX compatible.
Yeah. So you managed to fund like a year of development. Is that year already passed?
Yeah, that ended a couple of months ago now. I've kind of been plodding along doing some work anyway and kind of trying to figure out what I'm going to do next as far as funding. We'll see.
Yeah. Are you thinking about doing maybe another Kickstarter?
Well, that's a possibility. I can't say for sure right now, but I think that maybe when this podcast comes out, there might be something, or if not, keep your eyes peeled on my website and we'll see. You know, if you're interested in trying to help us continue, give me a yell. And maybe it'll be a way to do that. I hope so. I really don't want to drop off and just do it as a part-time project again, because that kind of thing slows development down a lot. And, you know, I'd still be developing it, but I probably wouldn't, you know, have quite the impetus to work on, say, Windows ports or things like that if I was doing it on my own.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you have any other kind of future plans that we didn't talk about already for, not only the assistant, but any products at all or projects?
I don't know. That's a pretty open-ended question. I can't really think of anything right now that I would like to talk about. You know, I mean, there's so much stuff that I'd like to do around making Git more accessible to people who aren't programmers. And that's kind of been what I've been working on for maybe the past 10 years with various projects, including Git Annex now. And, you know, it just seems to me that the more we're building this wonderful, wonderful stuff, and then we're only using it among ourselves. And that just seems like a shame, you know? And every way that we find to, you know, to push stuff out and make it more widely usable and, you know, twisted into ways that, you know, the Git developers originally, I remember coming onto the Git IRC channel at one point and saying, I'd like to check my Etsy directory into Git. And they were like, you're nuts. Git's a source control system. You can't do that, you know. So we really have to, you know, just keep pushing those boundaries. That's kind of my ongoing goal, I think.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter today somebody said something like, if you want to change the world for to be a better place, you you have to do it in like an open source, open standard way, and kind of be like the look to Wikipedia. Just imagine if Wikipedia had been like a closed proprietary system, it probably would have been bought up long ago and then closed or commercialized in a very ugly way.
Yeah, that's for sure. And also, you know, Wikipedia brought, not to the masses maybe, but it's brought revision control to a lot of people who wouldn't have used it. Now they can go back and dig around in history and see who added that weird comment about George Bush or something. And, you know, and so it's kind of, you know, it's also pushing out version control, even though it has its own ad hoc stuff. You know, it's all kind of the same thing, I think.
Are you looking for people to help you with the assistant or Git Annex?
I absolutely am. As a Haskell program, that kind of, you say that and suddenly, you know, you've dropped it down to 1% of the number of people who could have helped you before. I do get some patches. I've had some pretty good features contributed by people, and I have to say that they tend to just go right in and work a lot better than the patches that I get for other projects in other languages. I've also been, you know, with this hook stuff that lets you add support for different ways to store your data on different cloud services, you know, making that easy to use for people who don't write Haskell but can still contribute is something that I'd like to see more of those hooks be written. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways people can help out, I'm sure. Just, you know, give it a try and at least file good bug reports, and that'll be a wonderful help. But yeah, you know, you always want more people to contribute to whatever you're developing in open source, and getting them can always be hard. So we'll see. Hopefully more people are learning Haskell and will say, oh, here's another project I can contribute to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be able to say off the bat what is a famous Haskell project out there.
Yeah, there's so. Xmonad. That's the kind of that's kind of the wacky thing where you have to write Haskell to write your config file for your window manager, which is kind of how I learned.
I wanted to try it out sometime, but it kind of scared me off.
Yeah. I think that, you know, either Haskell's going to take off and we're going to get quite a lot of people using it, or, you know, at least the ideas will. We'll see.
Yeah, not to go too far off topic here, although we've done that a couple of times already. Being a Java developer, I see a lot of attention on Scala and Clojure.
Yeah.
And I think people who like Scala for the right reasons, they will, you know, like Haskell even more.
Yeah, I suspect that's true. I guess Scala's kind of got, or Clojure both have kind of the, you know, the JVM, right? But maybe we'll get a Haskell in the JVM. I don't know. That would be pretty neat.
I think that's a bit of the charming thing is that it, you know, compiles to to running on bare metal, and you don't need to have like the whole Haskell VM installed on your computer to use it, do you?
Yeah, right. No, you don't. But, you know, but having it on a platform that you're already using is good. And one of the big pushes in the Haskell community right now is what they call the JavaScript problem, which is that JavaScript sucks, but it's the only thing you can use in a web browser. And there's a lot of different projects now that compile Haskell down to JavaScript code that runs in a web browser quite well. And so I think that might be how it breaks out. We'll see. It's also good for system-level programming, though, like I'm doing with GitNX or even lower level.
Cool. Okay, are there any other things that you would like to promote apart from these projects?
No, I guess not.
And just let people know where they can find you online, and we'll be done.
Well, sure. My website is joeyh.name, and or you can just Google Joey Hess, and I'll pop up, I'm sure. And
cool.
Yep.
Excellent. Okay, Joey, thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Well, thanks a lot, Thomas. It was great.
And that's it for this episode. Once again, you can find the show notes on links.gitminutes.com/16. And there you can also support the show via Flatter or GitHub. A big thank you to those supporting the show already. You can post feedback or comments directly under the show notes, or you can send an email on feedback@gitminutes.com. You can follow the show on Twitter or Google+, where you'll be notified of any new episodes, or just head over to gitminutes.com to see all the different ways you can subscribe. Big thanks to danosongs.com for providing free music to the show. Until next time, thank you for listening.